Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Jordan Osserman, and today we're going to be speaking to Stijn van Hula, Derek Hook, and Callum Neal. These three are the authors, are the editors of Volume 1 of Reading Lacan's Écrit, a new three-volume series featuring paragraph-by-paragraph commentaries from scholars and clinicians on the complete edition of Lacan's Écrit. Volume 1 is entitled Reading Lacan's Écrit, From Signification of the Phallus to Metaphor of the Subject, and was published by Routledge in 2019. Before we get started, just a brief announcement from our channel. Do you love psychoanalysis? Like to read? Do you ever fantasize about having a conversation with the authors of psychoanalytic books you read? Well, you're in luck. New Books in Psychoanalysis is opening its doors to potential new hosts. We're also looking for social media savvy interns who can help us reach more listeners and spread the gospel of psychoanalysis. If either possibility interests you, please send me an email at jordan.osserman@gmail.com. Now on to the show. I'll begin by introducing our three editors. So Derek Hook will be joining us again, and he is an associate professor of psychology at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh and an extraordinary professor of psychology at the University of Pretoria. Derek's the author of Six Moments in Lacan, published in 2017, Post-Apartheid Conditions, published in 2014, and A Critical Psychology of the Postcolonial, published in 2011. His most recent book is an edited collection of Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe's prison letters entitled Lie on Your Wounds. He was one of the founding editors of the Palgrave Journal Subjectivity, and along with Callum Neal, co-edits the Palgrave Lacan book series, and we're very pleased to welcome him back to the channel. Stijn van Hula is professor of psychoanalysis and chair of the Department of Psychoanalysis and Clinical Consulting at Ghent University in Belgium. He's a psychoanalyst in private practice, a member of the New Lacanian School and the World Association of Psychoanalysis. And he's the author of a number of books, including The Subject of Psychosis, A Lacanian Perspective, and Psychiatric Diagnosis Revisited, From the DSM to Clinical Case Formulation. And finally, we'll be joined by Callum Neal, who's an associate professor of psychoanalysis and cultural theory at Edinburgh Napier University and director of Lacan in Scotland. Callum has written two books, the first entitled Without Ground, Lacanian Ethics and the Assumption of Subjectivity, and Ethics and Psychology, Beyond Codes of Practice. As well as Callum has written numerous articles and book chapters and indeed a play. And along with Derek, he runs the Palgrave Lacan series and is one of the editors of the series we'll be speaking about today. So it's really exciting that we have these three eminent Lacanian scholars and practitioners on board with us today. And I think it'll be a really interesting and original conversation being able not simply to speak to an author of a book, but to speak to the editors of a complicated and fascinating project about bringing commentary on the Écrit into a kind of systematic, kind of organized series of volumes. So welcome to the three of you.
Hi, Jordan. Thanks.
Thanks.
So maybe we could start with just discussing how did this whole thing come about? And I suppose whichever one of you kind of wishes to open up on that, I'd like to hear a bit about, where was the project? Who conceived of the project? And, what was involved in trying to get people to write for it? And kind of, what's the process been like?
Well, maybe I'll say a few things. I think the project really was the brainchild of Stain. It was a good few years ago now when he actually brought the idea up with Callum and myself. And I think part of the motivating idea here was that for many years we'd been relying on texts like the Muller and Richardson Lacan on Language, which was a useful, very, introductory basis for how to go about reading chapters within the Akri, but it always felt a little too short, not adequately developed. And of course, even that book, as valuable as it was, only selected a few chapters from the Akri. And of course, it predated the 2006 Bruce Fink full translation of the whole of the Akri into English. So that was the need underlying the project.
Right. So Stain, I wonder if you could say something about the three of you have a quite interesting introductory chapter to this volume about what kind of text actually is the Akri, and that kind of might help us grapple with why is this three volume work necessary. So maybe you could you just expand a bit on what exactly is the Akri? What kind of text do we encounter when we open it?
Well, Lacan's Akri is actually a collection of complex papers that were never meant originally to be grouped together in that volume, that have a known history, in terms of Lacan's teaching, that have a known context within which they originated, that echo Lacan's teaching in his seminars, that echo also like dialogues he was having, discussions he was having with actual colleagues or with other writers. So the Akri is a very complex bringing together of texts, and anyone who just tries to read the book, you buy the book and you start reading, you just don't manage reading the volume. So that's a basic observation that we all can make. So therefore we thought we needed some help in what are these different texts about. And then we indeed had the idea of inviting a number of scholars, a number of clinicians who had been working with specific texts in the past or who would be very well suited to provide a commentary, to give a systematic reading of the text in a very slow, easy way, introducing people to the different papers from the Akri, with the idea of making it more feasible for an individual reader to get access to the complex Lacanian
so,
ideas.
So I will go into the how you kind of decided to format the specific contributions in a minute, but one of the things I thought might be interesting to discuss at the outset is I've been in a kind of a Lacan seminar reading group for a number of years, and one of the things that always strikes me is just how much more readable the seminars are often than reading one of the Akri. Lacan is sort of notorious for his difficult style, but indeed that tends to apply much more to reading one of the Akri than it does to his seminars, which occasionally at least can be quite lucid. So what is it about the written Lacan as opposed to the spoken Lacan that can be so dense and kind of hard to work through?
I think the obvious answer there is that Lacan worked over the Akri much more. I mean, the seminars are done live. He's ad-libbing. He's free improvising through the seminars. So there's a spontaneity to them, whereas the Akri, he's working over the material. So the ideas are compacted and multi-layered. So you take any one paragraph in the Akri, it's full of a complex of ideas that have been worked over to fit together and can be unpacked in numerous different ways, which gives rise to this impossibility that Stain's alluding to, that many people, when they try and read the Akri, just they're just confronted with this impossible collection of words, and the idea that you can actually read the Akri and make sense of it for many people is, simply not a possibility. And that's one of the things that motivated us, is to tackle this impossibility and say, no, there is a possibility here. You can make some sense of it. It's not that the various commentaries that we put together are the definitive interpretation, but they are at least an interpretation, and they show right. the reader that it is possible to make sense of this dense work.
It's an interesting question, though, that we try to play with an introduction to the book. What exactly is a Cree? Obviously the answer would be it's a book, but as Dane has already suggested, and Callum as well, the book wasn't constructed and designed as a book initially, and there's some evidence to suggest that that it was only really Lacan's prospective editor who really wanted to see this thing in print. So we could also ask, what kind of texts are they in a Cree? And there's the famous offhanded comment Lacan makes, well, these things, the Cree, it's not meant to be read. And so we played around a little bit with the idea of, what kind of text is it? Is it a sort of labyrinthine, hysterical apparatus that makes us read and reread and still not understand? And I think that question is still very much part of how we're thinking about the text. That's almost an infinite text, that it's not simply to be read and digested as we may imagine a book would be, but it's really something that challenges us and demands multiple returns, multiple interpretive inquiries.
Right, because I recall at the end of the introduction, you offer, a plethora of interpretations of what kind of text the Cree might be, and you conclude by basically saying it's all of them. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's kind of open-ended. It's almost like an infinite text. It doesn't end.
What about this? Yes, go ahead.
Also, it's... Yeah, I just want to add that specifically, Lacan's texts are certainly not just a roundup of the seminars. It's also not just the preparation for the seminars. It's something that has a quite peculiar status. And in the introduction, we refer to Miller, who actually said that the Cree have a provocative function, meaning that his suggestion is that perhaps Lacan was formulating some of his more provocative ideas in the Écrits, meaning ideas that his audience wouldn't want to hear. And this would perhaps be a bit similar to this early text on the mirror stage. From that text, we know that Lacan gave it at an IPA conference, and that there was some trouble in him bringing his message, and therefore he wrote the paper. So there we see there is a paper was written because something could not be said. So maybe that's one way of looking at it. So Lacan was teaching, and that is it's an oral teaching. He was not reading notes. He was like free associating for his audience. And that afterwards he reflected on what did I forget to stress, and that probably the Écrits papers are such like accents in his oeuvre of things that he didn't want, that these would be forgotten by the psychoanalysts and his.
I wonder, is that what you mean by there's a kind of interesting enigmatic line in the introduction? The Écrits constituted the symptom of the seminars. Is that what you mean by that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And another thing that the three of you say in the introduction is that for Lacan himself, the medium of the spoken word is much more suitable than the written word for the transmission of psychoanalysis. So what kind of problems does that pose for the writing of the Écrits? And also, do you agree that is an issue, that the speaking is a more effective way of some kind of transmission than reading a text? Why don't we, Callum, if you have any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an obvious domain. Psychoanalysis is about speech. So Lacan, in the performance of the seminars, is doing something very close to the psychoanalytic experience. But psychoanalysis has always been subtended by the written text as well. So you know, the answer, yes, but also no.
Well, I also think that at that level, of course, this tells something about Lacan. Lacan, in the period that he was teaching, he was attracting people because of his style. And his style was a way of speaking that was very insisting. So it was some way of voice that was present. And I think in terms of what Lacan said, that probably his oral teaching was indeed the motor that fueled the transference. But I'm not sure whether this is always the case, that it's not sure that every teaching in psychoanalysis should be start from oral teaching. I think reading itself might work as well, but probably Lacan was not following that track. He was not such a good writer, actually. So his texts are very complex. It's very difficult to read the texts, which also illustrates that probably Lacan was not really fond of writing, but more fond of speaking.
I mean, it is, you know, I think you mentioned as well in the introduction how different, obviously, Freud's standard edition is to the Acri. You know, the standard edition is, you know, frequently commented upon as a kind of delightful, you know, piece of creative writing, as well as kind of transmission of psychoanalysis that's actually a pleasure to read, whereas the experience with the Acri is, you know, quite different.
Yeah, I think it's a nice comparison. It's something we playfully mentioned in the introduction, the idea that Freud's texts are, whether creative or not, are always rational, they're always lucid, they're always, they're kind of like instances of the secondary process, whereas with Lacan, we get almost a deliberately difficult filtering through dream work operations, unconscious structured like a language, where if anything, he causes us to work and to keep on coming back to the texts, which I suppose in some ways is also accounts for why
I'm having
this conversation.
So how did you decide on how exactly these kind of pieces of exegesis would be written? So I'm curious about what was the process around recruiting, you know, authors to write these? How did you decide on the format of each? Because so for each of the chapters of the book, there's a bit of context, kind of a bit of biographical context, and then there's a sort of paragraph by paragraph sort of analysis. So how did you kind of come up with that form? What was that process like, both coming up with the ideas and working collaboratively to do that?
One of the key aims of the three volumes was to produce a guide, something that could be read alongside the Kant's Acri. So really the format followed from that need. In order for it to be an actual guide that you could read in parallel with the original, it had to work from either sentence by sentence or a paragraph by paragraph commentary. So we vacillated a little bit there in terms of the precise format, but the basic format, I think, was set from the basic aspiration that we had when we initiated.
And within that, I mean, what do you see as the relationship between direct sort of exegesis, someone trying to just help the reader make sense of what Lacan is saying, versus the author's original argument? Because I noted in some of the chapters that, you know, the author has a point of view, and in some way that's going to be transmitted.
But this goes back to the point Derek was just making, that Lacan, in writing the Acri, is putting this to work. He's not writing in a form that's already packaged to fit with an understanding. He's trying to say something new. He's trying to push the reader to think. So when you read the Acri, you have to think. There's no way of reading the Acri without being challenged by it in some way, no matter how many times you've read it before. So it's inevitable then that our commentators are going to be, you know, not able to simply pluck out the idea from the text, but they're going to have to be challenged by the text and demonstrate that challenge through their own writing. So they're going to have a perspective. You can't read the Lacan without having a perspective on it. So there's two tiers to the teach of the commentaries. One, we were very, very keen that people root their reading in the text. That was an absolute for us. And we had some authors who came back with responses to the Akri, which were really bouncing off the Akri and going into other interesting, valuable ideas.
But right, so that's a really interesting editorial challenge.
Absolutely, this has to be rooted in the text. Yes. there was certainly, I mean, the project has taken years of our lives, and it threw up many challenges, and that, I think that was one of the key challenges, was actually just making sure people actually did that basic task of follow the text. Of course you're going to have your own voice in there. Of course you're going to have your own interpretation. There are going to be arguments to be made, but it has to be rooted in the text.
And what influence did some of the earlier attempts to do something like this, what influence did that have? So I know, Derek, you mentioned the Muller and Richardson, and I know Bruce Fink also has produced a number of kind of commentaries on the Akri. So did that play a role in how you conceived of this, and how do you see this as different from those earlier attempts?
Those texts are tremendously helpful. I mean, you know, the more work that appears in English, the more that the domain of secondary scholarship on Lacan and the English-speaking world has developed, the more some of those more expository texts seem a little bit elementary. So they're helpful, but I suppose what really sets this project apart is, and as Callum was alluding, a lot of our contributors couldn't quite believe that this is what we were asking. We wanted a paragraph-by-paragraph exposition, which may involve some further interpretive gestures, but that was really trying to be as faithful an engagement with the text line by line as could be, and that really doesn't exist. And a couple of people actually who know the Lacanian literature in French and other languages have said to me, "Wow, isn't it odd that the first language that we have a book of this sort is actually in English?" Which was a bit startling. I would have imagined that, you know, in French or whatever, there would have been other paragraph by paragraph expositions. But to the best of my knowledge, there aren't any. So that's the thing I think that really sets it aside from those other projects. One other thing to add to that is we've been very fortunate in who we've been able to get to contribute to the project. I mean, you know, after the fact, you can always say, well, it would have been nice to have even a larger global spread of contributors. But certainly many of the luminaries, many of the most respected scholars and colleagues that we've been reading, you know, as we sort of came to the forefront or started engaging Lacanian theory, have been willing to contribute. So that makes the volume that much richer, I think, that it's not just one school or one kind of Lacanian orthodoxy or one scholar, but a variety of people from different perspectives who are each contributing to the book.
In some way, it was a challenge, of course, for all of the authors, because we wanted them to do something else compared to what they usually do. Usually, an author is writing a paper because you have an idea and you want to expand that idea, and you use some ideas of a Lacanian text to kind of explain what you're reflecting on. What we asked is that our contributors really turned to the text, and that was indeed difficult for some of them to kind of neglect some aspects of the text, and we wanted to provide them a systematic reading. But at the same time, we immediately thought that we will only get a reading of a text. So we don't have the ambition with the book of providing like the correct interpretation. No, it's just one interpretation, and it has the advantage of being explicit. And we hope to open up like discussions of people not agreeing with our volumes, or making different interpretations of specific paragraphs or specific sentences, because that's actually scholarly work, systematic, out into the open, not just repeating difficult formulas that Lacan wrote, but explaining how you read a specific line, given the broader context of Lacan's oeuvre and of Lacan's, the topics he was working on, that specific moment.
That's really great. I wonder if did anything surprise you about Lacan in this process? One of the things I thought, of course, is that you know, there are certain Ikri that receive much more commentary in the Lacanian world than others. So, you know, were there any Ikri that you might have ignored or that you felt were somewhat neglected that in the process of putting this together, you realized had a new importance?
Let me just add a little thing about that. I don't know what my colleagues think. I mean, one of the great advantages, of course, was some of the Ikri have been commented on before in expository forms, but a lot of them hadn't. And so, one of the big adventures for me certainly was Danny Nobis's chapter on Kant with Sade. Really did take things a whole lot further than I'd been able to by tracking some of the secondary literature. So,
yeah, if I understand correctly, that one became such a massive project for him that he ended up also writing an entire book on it.
There was that. It also happened with Adrian Johnston, although his chapter's in the follow-up volume, The Freudian Thing. So in some ways, I suppose we ended up generating more scholarship than we could even fit within the books. But I suppose for me, if I was trying to answer your question, there were many eye-opening moments. But what was really, really helpful was just to get scholars being able to develop in such detail these different interpretive openings into texts that I think many of us have struggled with before, or sometimes have not even wanted to start struggling with, just thinking that it's going to be so opaque and difficult. And that's been great. I mean, another one that was really helpful, particularly with students that I've been using a lot, is Todd McGowan's chapter on the signification of the phallus. I mean, just left in its form in the Ikri, I find it very hard to do much with that. But Todd's chapter, its exposition and the way he takes us through various arguments, I think is for me at least, and working with students, is absolutely tremendous, particularly when it comes to a concept like the phallus, which for various obvious reasons tends to be a little problematic for some.
Yeah, I mean, echoing that, there's not one particular Ikri that's emerged from this thinking, you know, oh my God, I've never read that in that Ikri before, I read it in that way before. It really was across the board. Every single piece in all three of the volumes had a light shone on it that's, because it was someone else's light, brought new things out. It makes you read the Ikri in a different way, which I guess is one of the aims.
So would you say there are certain kind of received understandings of Lacan that this text may have troubled? Could you think of any?
Well, I think mainly that I would say it in another way. Some of the authors had a hard job because they didn't find any relevant other commentaries. Like, for example, the text on an ex post facto syllabary that was commented on by L. Goldman Baldwin. That, for example, is a text that hardly any Lacanian scholar ever is discussing. So, but at the same time, we started from the idea it's not a coincidence that Lacan included these texts in the Ikris. So for him, it must have been something that was important. So therefore, we wanted that, given the length of the papers, there would be like some kind of balance in the amount of words that an author could write about the chapter he or she was writing on, to make sure that it was a balanced commentary. Because some of the texts that have been commented on frequently would lend themselves to very large texts, and then we would have a more like unstable reading of the Ikri.
I mean, I can imagine, you know, a traditional kind of edited collection of essays, the editors have to kind of, make sure that the quality is good, but the authors are sort of, you know, free to kind of make their own, you know, contribution. But I would imagine that putting this together, you would have to work very closely with the authors. And I wonder, you know, if you had to kind of suggest things for them to read or help guide them through when they were a bit lost, or what was the kind of individual work with authors like in this putting this together?
Well, there is not one answer to that. It is mixed, of course. Like Derek said, concerning some papers, we were the ones who were really learning from the authors. But on the other hand, we could indeed offer suggestions, and sometimes we had to give feedback to people that must have been hard for them to hear that. But the idea, the basic idea was quite clear. We wanted to have a commentary that highlights every paragraph, every line of every text. And so basically, if someone was neglecting about a couple of pages because it was too dense or too difficult, we wanted this author to return to the pages and to indeed work on these. So that was not always easy. And that's also why it took time to have people write the way we wanted them to write.
So one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading this is Lacan, we know, entered the English-speaking world primarily through sort of the academic humanities rather than the clinic. There's indicators that the English reception of Lacan is beginning to change, that as he's become sort of less trendy, perhaps, as a kind of quote-unquote post-structuralist thinker in the humanities, that more and more the Lacanian clinic is making an impact. Do you see this book as intervening in any way in that that sort of tension between Lacan as someone who's used in sort of critical studies in literary theory versus Lacan as a clinician?
I think the fact that the three of us come from different backgrounds ourselves kind of reflects an answer to that, that we were trying to cover all bases. We're not seeing Lacan as purely of relevance to clinicians or purely of relevance to cultural theorists. But we're trying to cover the whole spectrum here because Lacan is used in these different fields. And that's one of the great things about Lacan. He's rich enough to use very productively, whether you're looking at film theory or clinical practice or politics. He has this application across the board. And we want these books to be of value to students and academics and practitioners across the board.
Yeah, probably. I think when reading a chapter, you might see from which background an author is coming, but we didn't want that to have a very big impact on the commentary that was written. The idea was that the authors should not contribute starting from their applied specific background. Is it film studies or is it clinical work? But rather to go for a truly conceptual discussion, a bit apart from our other more like applied focus on a specific topic. So we wanted all authors to kind of return to the text itself. So therefore, I don't think that these volumes can be situated in terms of a turn towards the clinic. The only thing we'd say, Lacan is about clinic. Always, but it's not that these volumes are like hinting to some clinical applications that were not discussed by Lacan, not at all.
No, I completely agree. I suppose what's noteworthy about this is it's one of perhaps an increasing number of texts where you have academic theorists and clinicians, you know, sometimes embodied in the same person, but other times, communicating with one another in a way that in English texts on Lacan you didn't previously see very much.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that. It's also, I suppose, maybe just because I've been focusing a little bit on the final stages of the second volume, but there are quite a few chapters there which really do bring the clinical stuff to the in the forefront. I mean, Steyn's got a chapter in the second volume on psychosis, on a question prior to any possible treatment. There's also a number of chapters actually that are located in Lacan's thinking in the 50s about how to teach psychoanalysis. What is the situation of psychoanalysis? And of course, there's also, sorry to focus a little bit on the second volume, but there's also a very important commentary chapter in the Acri on the direction of the treatment. So while I agree with my colleagues, I think I also agree with you, Jordan. I think that there is maybe slightly more clinical stuff than some people may have expected. Certainly in volume two, if they've just come to Lacan through literary, for example, applications. That being said, though, of course, Volume 1 has got Jean-Michel Rabatet's contribution. It's the fifth chapter on Guide. There's also the Danny Nobis, which is on Sade. So, you know, there's clearly a little bit of both of them there. I suppose I was also noticing just in some sections of Cree, the Cree, how intensely Lacan was engaging with his peers and other psychoanalysts at the time, and really very much trying to clarify, experiment, but also refine the conceptual apparatus of psychoanalysis at the time. So that's one way, I think, also of responding to your question, is that while the book is certainly not the first volume or the second volume, certainly not overly focused on clinical stuff, there is an attention to those concepts that he's introducing or utilizing to refine what he thinks has become a kind of conceptual muddiness and laziness within the psychoanalytic world of his time.
Yeah, I mean, I recall most recently when I was reading Paul Verhaeghe's contribution to the book, you know, it's the case when reading Lacan and as well when reading this text is that there's so many different sources that it draws your attention to different theories that you might want to learn about from, you know, from the world of mathematics, from the world of anthropology or biology or whatever it is. You know, there's so much beyond the field of psychoanalysis that one is called to study when reading Lacan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how my colleagues would approach this, but one of the most fascinating questions in the world of Lacan really is, what is the ideal vessel, the ideal form for the transmission of psychoanalytic ideas? So, you know, in Freud, obviously, there's reference to myths, there's a great deal of reference to literature. And of course, Lacan, you could say in his career, there's multiple different attempts to think how to formalize and transmit psychoanalytic ideas, whether it's through the mathemes, whether it's through certain types of formalism, whether it's through mathematics or so on and so forth. I think that's all part of the kind of adventure. And those are various ways of maybe trying to approach the enunciation or formalization of what ultimately maybe can't quite be said.
Yeah, one of the other things you mentioned, Derek, is about how you know there's a kind of you're fortunate to have people from different kind of Lacanian orientations or schools. I wonder if you found that the fact that this is a text written in English allowed you to bypass some of the kind of factionalisms that exist in the Lacanian world.
I think to some extent that was the case. Steyn would be much better placed to talk about how we are located relative to the broader international network of scholars, analysts who are working in the field. But I don't know. I sometimes think that in the English-speaking world, we've got a little chip on our shoulder or a little bit nervous about, like, you know, the massive edifice of French speaking, and not just French, Spanish-speaking Lacanians across the world. I think there's some truth in that, but on the other hand, as I mentioned before, it's kind of refreshing that we've managed to do this thing in English, which apparently doesn't really have a precedent, in as much as we've got this three-volume English commentary on paragraph sections of the Cree. I don't know. What do you think, Steyn?
Well, I think this book or these three volumes are, of course, the result of a certain position that we as editors took. And we as editors did not start as members of this school or another school, but rather, I think, as scholars, as academics. We met each other, the three of us, we know each other through an academic conference. And so we met as academics, and we wanted some serious study of Lacan that is not influenced by specific, like, political readings, like the policies of the different societies and schools, and that is not influenced by a certain selection that is made at these levels in terms of who should contribute, who should not contribute. No, we wanted some overall study of Lacan, and then we just started checking who could we ask. And we actually didn't really wonder who is from which school. We rather searched the field of people that we thought were writing interesting things, and in which of which we had the idea that these were persons that could contribute like an original clarifying paper on Lacan. So it had more to do with what we thought people could bring in terms of clarifying Lacan rather than for which is their background.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I think the fact that we've been starved for so long in the English-speaking world may have been part of what has motivated us doing this text. Because, you know, a colleague observed to me some years ago, he said, isn't it amazing that the original Lacri appears in, what, 1966? And in the English-speaking world, it's only 2006 when Bruce Fink's full translation emerges. I mean, it's kind of odd. It's kind of incredulous that time lag has happened. And I remember once Jacqueline Miller having this comment, I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but someone reported it saying, well, no, I'm taking my time in getting the translations done into English because the longer we wait, the more it builds desire. It's kind of a frustrating thing to hear, but whether it's true or not, when he puts it like that, I think part of what's motivated us to do this is that we don't have more access. We haven't had the full version of the ICRI in English that long. And in trying to gather all these contributions, I think we are really trying to find descriptions, interpretations that we weren't able to access before.
So yeah, I mean, I guess I wonder, so why now? Why this particular moment for this book? Is it simply the normal lapse of time required between the publication of the full ICRI and this kind of commentary? Or is there something about this particular moment where you felt we really need to have this full extended commentary on all the ICRI now?
I think the thing is, the particular moment was some years ago, because it's taken us so long to get to this point. So. It wasn't that long after the full publication of the ICRI that we started talking about doing this, but it's been such a complex project because we had such a clear but fixed idea of what we wanted in terms of this paragraph by paragraph commentary. We've had dropouts, we've had numerous frustrations along the way. So in a sense, the project has frustrated our desires, but kept our desires going along the way. And still, we're not quite there yet. The third volume is still in progress.
I mean, another thought is, I know it sounds silly to talk about different generations of Lacan scholarship, but I think in a way you could say, if we're just playing with this argument, that a condition of possibility for these books, for this series, was the coming into their own of a series of scholars that perhaps are more of our generation. So I'm thinking of Ed Plyth, for example. I'm thinking both of Callum also and Stain, their own contributions to the book. And it's kind of helpful that we've had Yael Goldman, Baldwin's another one, as is Stephanie Swales. I think it kind of helps that there's this, you know, excuse the cliched phrase, whatever, this emerging generation or something of Lacan scholarship, which has helped. Because certainly, I think when the three of us started doing Lacan stuff, there was, you know, a series of fairly big established names in the English-speaking world, and not just the English-speaking world, but increasingly the developments that have happened in the secondary literature mean that important new stuff is coming out. And I think that's really propelled the project. Callum and I also have a work on another book series, and I think we've seen that as well, where we've been genuinely impressed by even work that good PhD students have done in their doctorates on Lacan. And so in a way, despite that maybe Lacan is not as trendy or fashionable as he once was in you know, so-called post-structural scholarship, it's a tremendously exciting time to be working in Lacanian theory, just because the general base level of scholarship, I think, has risen quite dramatically, and there's more available literature to work on.
Stain, did you have something you wanted to add? I saw your little hand up.
Oh, that was already up like 15 minutes.
Okay.
I just had another thought. I'm going to say it. Like at the same time, it's not the idea that with these books that we want to close something. It's not that we have the definitive guide to Lacan, or the definitive guide to Lacan's decrees. Decrees, indeed, these were published in 1966. It's actually quite early Lacan. It's the Lacan from the early seminars that we hear, and the texts were published that in that specific period. But there is Lacanian work before the Ecrisse, and there is quite some Lacanian work after the Ecrisse. So he wrote other texts after the Ecrisse. So we have another challenge, meaning that it was only part of Lacan's oeuvre that is translated in English, and it's the Ecrisse. But now we have in French the Autre Ecrisse, which is also something that we already discussed. Should we write or edit volumes now on Autre Ecrisse, or what should we do? Because we cannot say that this was the last word that had to be said about.
And what are some of the differences between you think this kind of later version of text and the current the Ecrisse? What's the significance of us not having access to this right now?
Well, these volumes are certainly a product of the English translation being published in 2006. That's for sure. But at the same time, we know that there are other texts as well, and some of these have not yet been translated. So we're waiting for another momentum. There will come another momentum to do something similar with other things. With for example, the moment Autre Ecrisse is translated in English. But there is more work that needs to be done.
And I wonder.
I mean, we know from reading the seminars how Lacan's thought, like Freud before him, was constantly in process of evolving and turning back and reconsidering, picking up new ideas, dropping ideas. And, you know, as Stein says, what we've done is we've produced these commentaries on a certain period of Lacan's work, but, you know, those ideas evolve and turn, move forward, move back, transform into other things, and that's works.
And I wonder, Derek, you mentioned how great it is that there's this kind of newer generation of Lacanian scholars who were able to take part in this project. And one of the things that made me think of as well is that many people in this newer generation, have an interest in all kinds of other fields. So you have Eve Watson, who's written a book on queer theory and psychoanalysis. Todd McGowan, of course, writes about film theory and has had a lot to say about feminist film theory. So do you think that some of these other the author's interest in some of these other areas, political, feminist, queer, cultural studies, whatever it may be, did that shape in some way how these Ecrisse were read?
I mean, I think that stuff and the multiplicity of the various interests, directions, exemplifications, examples of the authors is absolutely tremendous. Just because one of the difficulties of going back to Lacan and going back to the Ecrisse and going back to ideas, a lot of them are in the 50s that he's working on at the time, is he's constantly giving exemplifications and examples. And one of the difficulties in reading Lacan in English is not simply the ornate Baroque style that he layers on us so as to keep us guessing and not understanding. But it's also at a very straightforward level, aside from the obvious factor of translation, is it's so difficult for us to properly engage with many of the examples, the books, the literature, in some instances also films, ideas, philosophers that were his contemporaries. So I think we run the risk at some point in thinking, okay, we're going to do the purest Lacan thing and then we'll just locate him and we'll do a clear exposition of all the sources he was engaging at the time. If one does that, that's helpful. That's great. That's half the task. But I think it also helps to put the ideas to work today as well, to give new exemplifications, new tests, new experiments of how the ideas might be applied. Because indeed, that's what Lacan himself seems to have been doing. So I think it's that tension between doing, good expositions, but also expositions that don't are not limited to the frame of reference and time when they were first articulated, that they need to be, as it were, metabolized or put into contact with contemporary developments, social theory, understandings, different disciplines. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do. And it's good to see, and I think this is also what we're hoping to do in the forthcoming ECRI conference, where we'll launch the second of the books, is that when we started collecting papers and people started submitting ideas for what to present, we kept on stressing it's about the ECRI, so keep the ECRI in there. And people did that, but they were able to take it in a great number of different directions.
Would one of you like to say something about this conference? Because I know that's coming up and is a kind of big moment for this project.
Stane could start us off by talking about the conference he organized last year, because this is the second in a series of conferences. So if Stane's willing to do that, then I'll say something afterwards.
Yeah, we had the first one in Ghent last year with a big audience, indeed with papers both focusing on the ECRIs themselves and giving further commentaries, and more applied papers in which people use ideas from ECRIs to clinical questions, cultural study questions. It was very open, but the idea was start from something that has to do with the ECRIs. And that was a very engaging conference with many dialogues, many discussions, like a very good atmosphere, very lively atmosphere, very open discussions and conversations. A number of these papers have also now been grouped in a journal that we will bring to Duquesne when the conference is there in Pittsburgh. And yeah, so the idea now is now we have volume two, and we have a conference number two, and then we are with Derek again.
Yeah, I mean, one of the limitations of having had the first conference, however successful it was, apparently I wasn't there, but I think it was a fantastic success, is just that lots of people in North America found it a little bit more difficult to get there. So if we have alternating conferences, I suppose what we're saying is that the 2019 event, which we'll be hosting at Duquesne University, Pittsburgh, between the 11th and 13th of October, is that a lot of people who are based in North America would more easily be able to get there. But it also just makes me think, some of the comments earlier on, we were discussing, Lacan's ideas of what at some level might be the best form of transmission, the idea that the seminars are spoken. It's kind of nice that the conferences were organized precisely to introduce and launch the book. So what that means then is we'll launch the second volume at this coming conference, and some of the people who've contributed both to the first volume and to the second and indeed to the third will speak, and they will present some of the papers that they have prepared, their expositions for the book. But there's a whole plethora of different perspectives and papers. And so we have a nice conjunction of a series of spoken interventions alongside the text that we've prepared themselves. But the conference is looking pretty exciting. We've got Annie Rogers is doing one of our keynotes, as is Danny Novus. We'll be having a book launch on the second night of the conference, where we'll launch the second volume of Reading Lacan's ECRI, but also Bruce Fink's new translation of, I think it is volume seminar six. We've also got Stane and Callum are both doing keynotes, as is Stephanie Swales. So is Todd McGowan. So we've really got an impressive array of people. And, I've spent many years going to psychoanalysis conferences trying to get a little bit more Lacan and getting bits. But what's kind of refreshing about this event is that if you're taking Lacan seriously, or you're interested in Lacan, is that the whole thing is going to be about Lacanian psychoanalysis in the ECRI. So that's also kind of exciting for us.
And I think it underscores the idea that Stane was talking about earlier, that the production of the three volumes was not meant to be a definitive word. It wasn't closing it down saying we've done the ECRI now. And the fact that the conferences really underscores that and opens it up and says, we've produced the books. That's the start of a conversation. Now come to the conference and engage in that conversation.
All right. Well, so we're beginning to run out of time here. So I thought, just as a final kind of closing question, and apologies if this is a bit of a difficult one to answer on the spot, but I wonder if each of you might be able to say something about a particular ECRI contribution that you helped to edit that you particularly enjoyed or learned something from, or it opened something up for you. Whoever wants to begin first, that'd be great. Be great to hear.
I'll go first, just because I'm scared one of my colleagues is going to steal what I was going to talk about. there's a bunch of them, but certainly in terms of the first volume, the Kant with Sard, Kant of Exar, Danny Nobis's chapter was really an adventure, just in terms of how much additional archival work that he did, and how that text really does make one understand things in a slightly different way. So that was a moment for me, as was Todd McGowan's, which I've mentioned before, just because that signification of the Fallas paper has always proved so difficult, at least for me, not for everybody, but I'm presuming a lot of people, and for students. And, you know, he really does make the point very strongly, for example, in his chapter that, well, you know, sometimes people think, well, you've got these two paradigms through which one should view sexuation. You know, there's this kind of biological, and then there's this cultural, social constructionist one. And then often there's an inclination to think, well, a psychoanalytic one just falls under a kind of culturalist perspective. And he makes the argument very strongly that no, it doesn't. It's got very strong critical things to say about that assumption in and of itself, that you really need a third direction to think psychoanalytically what sexuation is. So those were two of my most appreciated chapters where I felt I really learned something new.
Yeah, Derek, you mentioned already too, so...
It's okay, we can have repeats. I'm sure you all got things from them.
Yeah. I'm gonna mention one paper from the third volume that will be published, which is on the first part of the Acris. There we will have a very good paper by Dominique Huns on logical time, which is like a nerdy paper of Lacan, but a paper with a huge impact on Lacan's entire teaching, because there he's already focusing on logics, he's already focusing on division, and the divided subject. It's not the concepts that he uses there, but it's a very early text, very dense, and Dominique really succeeds in explaining the clue of that paper. But I could mention many more other papers, but that was one that I particularly enjoyed reading.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with both Steyn and Derek that, you know, the particular papers they point out. But I'm going to cheat in my answer and say the paper that really opened my eyes was my own contribution, because it was the very fact of having to write a commentary. I found such a challenge that made me really engage with the Acris in a different way. And I think all of our authors, I'm hoping Derek and Steyn will echo this, have experienced the same thing, that you think you know the Acris, you think you know particular papers in the Acris, but when you actually come to articulate your own understanding of it, it puts you in a very different position. So I would invite all the readers to read our volumes, but then turn back to the Acris and try it for themselves.
Fabulous. Well, Derek, Steyn, Callum, this has been such a delight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you, Jordan.
Okay. That was a pleasure. Yeah.